What should therapists do and definitely not do during a psychotherapy session? Welcome back to Making Therapy Better with Dr. Bruce Wampold, the podcast where we give voice to the clinicians and researchers who are helping to drive this field forward. Our guest today, Dr. Mick Cooper, is professor of counseling psychology at the University of Roehampton. He's an internationally recognized author and trainer, and he's the mind behind such influential books as Existential Therapies and Working at Relational Depth in Counseling and Psychotherapy. Today, Bruce and Mick compare their notes on some of the pitfalls and common signs of bad therapy. And if you stick around later in the episode, they have a lot of fun with live role plays as they demonstrate some really bad therapy, and I think some pretty darn good therapy too. And let's be honest, for those of us who practice, we've all probably done quite a bit of both at different points in our career, maybe at different points today. So whether you agree or disagree with what Bruce and Mick have to say, or if you want to add your own list of things that therapists should avoid, please drop it in the comments. We would sure love to hear from you. It really helps us out, and we appreciate your support. And with that, let's cut to Bruce and Mick with the latest episode of Making Therapy Better.
Hello, Mick.
How are you, Bruce?
Thank you for agreeing to be on the podcast. This is
my
very
pleasure.
Exciting. As you know, we've known each other for a long time and greatly respect your work. In reviewing your materials for this interview, I watched some of your podcasts, your videos, and read your work again. But one video really stood out to me, and that's where you talked about, I think it was 13 things that therapists should not do. And I go, this is so interesting, because we're always talking about what therapists should do, okay? And you and I, you know, intimately involved in therapy, supervising therapists, training therapists, and I thought this was so interesting. And partly because I also have a list of things that I think therapists should never do or never say. And there was some overlap, but there's also some disagreement. So I thought, well, this would be great. Let's talk about what each of us think a therapist should not do. So I'm going to ask you, for five or six that are on your list, and I'll talk about some of mine. And then we're going to role play some of these, and then hopefully demonstrate what not to do, in our opinion, and then also give an alternative response, which would be, in our opinion, more effective. Now, what's interesting, I think, is that, there's not agreement among therapists about some of these things. But hopefully, in our discussion and role plays, we'll come to some agreement about what should be avoided in therapy. So let's get started. I'm going to ask you, name four, five, six things that you think therapists should not do.
Thanks, Bruce. And just to start by saying, it's a great honor to be here. You're a hero of mine and many people, I think, in the psychotherapy world. And I was thinking, you know, as you were saying that about doing a video about what not to do, being a person-centered therapist, it's probably not very person-centered to be focusing on the kind of not things. Yep. It should be about unconditional positive regard and acceptance. But I think there's something about kind of focusing on what not to do kind of helps clarify and maybe what it is that we're trying to train people to do. And really, so it's a bit kind of tongue in cheek. And of course, some of these things we will end up doing, and it's not about policing ourselves, but it is trying to say, you know, where can we learn and what are the things that we have to watch out for? So, I mean, I've got a list of 13.
Well, before you start,
yeah,
I just want to comment on that because I think it's important. Because
okay.
You said, you know, person-centered therapy, you know, we're want to avoid giving advice or being direct. But in supervision, I mean, really becoming more and more apparent to me that to become a better therapist, feedback and specific feedback is really important. And I see therapists in training wanting to say, yeah, I know you're being polite, you're trying to help me here, but tell me what I'm doing wrong. So I think we're onto something here about in training to give feedback more specifically about therapist activity.
Yep. Yeah, and I think, so to talk about one thing that I think therapists sometimes do that's not helpful is being too passive and not giving, exactly what you say, Bruce, not giving feedback, giving too much kind of space and silence. I mean, you know, we know from Heidi Levitt's research that silence can be fantastic, but we saw in our research with kids that one of the things I most found difficult in the counseling was when the counselor, I'm sure the best one in the world, was trying to be empathic and give space, but actually that they felt that they weren't getting anything. And I think particularly for us humanistic counselors, there can be a danger of sometimes just not responding, not being engaged, not being active. And I think clients can experience that as uncomfortable, which then makes them, you know, we've seen some of our young people, like they're wondering, do I want to be here? Because this is so awkward. You know, I've said something and they're just not giving me anything back. So
yeah,
I think that can be, you know, I think under the spirit, in the spirit of empathizing and listening, sometimes it can come across as just too disengaged.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it might be internally we're engaged, but I think sometimes there's a mistake of thinking of what's going on internally for you, that clients can read that and they can't always read that. You know, you might be whirring away with empathy and understanding and genuine loads and stuff, but unless clients see that, they can feel that things are, you know, like what's going on. So that would be a first one from me. Is about being kind of not being too passive in the work. I mean, the other side of that, and it's all about balance, Bruce, as I'm sure you agree, is like talking too much. And just, you know, I hear a lot of clients on the side, well, I went to this therapist and he started telling me about his marriage and what was going on and, you know, and what I should do. I mean, I remember seeing a CBT therapist once and he just went on and on about how he lived his life and how I should do things like him and how if I stopped worrying about this, and he was very relaxed and he enjoyed his movies and his films. And what was interesting, Bruce, is, you know, I was a therapist. I didn't say anything. I didn't challenge him. I mean, I think, you know, initially I tried to maybe kind of bring myself back into the conversation, but pretty soon I just gave up. You know, I carried on going, but I just gave up. And we know from the research that with deference as a client, that often we don't say, when we're clients, often we don't say what's difficult, we don't say what's problematic, we just kind of let it go. And you know, there's a power differential that means that it's picking up on these things and picking up on what's not going right is really important. You kind of have to give space for it.
Yeah.
So that's,
well, this is one we agree on, is therapists talking too long or too much. And you gave an example of some talking about irrelevant things, but even if the therapist is spot on, they say too many points and then ask a question at the end, and even if they're spot on, gets lost, because we know from communication you can only take in one or two points.
Yep.
So even a psychodynamic therapist making an interpretation, for instance, it might be that, yeah, that's really insightful, but it talked about five or six different defenses, and I can't digest that.
You can't phrase it. It's like, stop. But then, I mean, that brings me on to the third one, Bruce, which is for me about exactly what you say, is about being too cognitive and not allowing the client to drop into the emotion. And I think when you're saying about, as well as not being able to process 6-7 different interpretations and understandings, as a therapist, you have to help a client connect with the emotional experiencing that's going on for them and the feeling. And we know from the evidence that that emotional connection is really strongly. We did a study with kids in counseling, and we found that there was such a strong, the one thing that predicted outcomes was the level of emotional experiencing. So if you're, as a therapist, just having a kind of cognitive conversation, it's not to say that that's not sometimes helpful. And I think sometimes clients need that and they appreciate that. But that connecting with the feeling and understanding what the emotion is, certainly with, when I train people to begin with, that's often the most important and challenging bit, is like cognitively they'll get maybe what the client's saying, or they'll be able to talk about it, or like you say, intellectually, they'll make an interpretation. But actually just sitting with the emotion in a present way, as I was saying, not just kind of disappearing, but actively being present with that emotion. And our colleagues in emotion focus therapy world have some great techniques and great ways of working with that, that really allow, more structured approaches, but I think allow that engagement and that emotional engagement. So that'd be my third. You asked for four, Bruce. And the fourth one that I would give you, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your thought, but the fourth one is, and again, this is something that comes out by research, is just about being a bit weird as a therapist, like having a lot of mannerisms like that, or a kind of, so look, I don't know if you notice this, but I've sometimes seen trainees that when they start practicing, it's like their voice and their facial mannerisms change. It's like they become a different person when they go into the room with a client or when they're doing their skills practice, rather than, it's just yourself there with a client, focused on the client, talking about the client, but you don't have to become a different person. I mean, again, obviously it's about, wanting to do it seriously, and maybe sometimes it's important to kind of get into that different role a bit. But we found that with the kids that we looked at when they talked about it, sometimes they just thought their counselor was a bit strange. It's like, who is this person? It's about kind of genuineness, congruence, and kind of recognizing that. And it goes back to the thing about silence, that our clients aren't necessarily used to the culture that we, recognizing that we're in a culture, we get trained in a culture, in our person-centered world, we learn to sit in a room for like hours with nobody saying anything. And it's easy to forget that actually that is a weird thing in the real world. So kind of keeping that one foot in the world of reality and just being a human is really important. Bruce, what's your four?
Well, I want to comment on the last two, because they overlap with mine. The affect is so important, which you talk about. And I think we're going to spend today some time on that, because as a person-centered therapist and somebody who focuses on affect, I want to talk about that, because I think it's one of the most difficult things, particularly for beginning therapists. So one of the things I put on my list is avoiding affect, because I've seen so many videos of therapists when there's just something clearly important going on, and they ask a factual question. And it's partly this avoidance of the difficult material. And we know, Mick, it isn't just kind of psychodynamic or emotion-focused or person-centered therapy that depends on emotion, but CBT. And sure, the CBT therapists are recognizing this, that the affect is absolutely critical. So avoiding affect, I think, is an important one for us to talk about. Maybe that's a place to dive in.
Mm-hmm.
The second one you mentioned is this kind of weirdness or strange. I say it a little differently. I say beginning therapists particularly have therapists speak. They sound like therapists. They'll say phrases like, "I understand how difficult this is." And it's just kind of like, I need to sound like a therapist. And it's what Tim Anderson talks about as verbal fluency. How natural sounding are you? No one wants to sit with somebody who is this kind of my therapist persona, right? I want to talk to a person, and I want this to sound natural. Now, you're going to do some things in therapy that, you know, we ordinarily don't do with friends or in normal conversation. But let's sound like a real person, not like imitating a therapist. So I agree on those two. So
Bruce, just on that one, when I trained in co-counseling, I used to have a trainer who would always say, I'm sorry anybody ever told you that you were, you know, not worthy, or I'm sorry anybody ever told you that you were, you know, kind of your hair was, there was too much gel in your hair. And, you know, once is fine. I'm sorry anybody ever told you that. But when every single response was, I'm sorry anybody ever told you that, I'm sorry anybody ever told you, you feel like you're not talking to a real person. You actually, you don't feel listened to, because it doesn't feel like somebody's engaging with the kind of particularities of what you're saying.
Yeah.
It just feels, and it ends up not feeling good because it feels too depersonalizing.
Yeah. So don't begin a sentence with, I'm sorry that.
Once is fine. If you are genuinely sorry that something happened.
Yeah.
But when you just say, I'm sorry, everyone was, you think, you're not sorry. You're just saying that.
Or I understand how you feel. Well, here's one that in our exchange before the podcast you disagree with, and it's one that you say you often use, but I tell the therapist that I'm training never to say, beginning the session with, how was your week? And the reason I dislike that phrase or find it not helpful for the client is it often invites the client to tell some story about something that happened during the week. And the stories might go on for quite some time. Or if they're not engaged in therapy, they might say something like, well, that it was fine, you know. And it's losing for me the theme of what we've been working on, which is one of the difficulties beginning therapists have, and that is having a coherent theme in the session and between sessions.
Yeah.
So I might start a session more directly, like, you know, we've been discussing how difficult it is to tell your partner when you're angry at them, and we've discussed how, you know, in your background that that was an adaptive response. But you've really been making an effort to be able to say that to your spouse when you really are irritated or angry with them. So was there an incident this week where you felt angry and, well, maybe I'd say it better this way. Tell me about an incident this week when you were angry to the spouse, and what went through your mind when that happened, and what you did.
Yeah.
Now, I'll leave room if something really important happened this past week. Let's deal with it. But I want to keep the theme going, and that is to be able to express what we might term negative emotions in your relationship with your partner.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, Bruce, I absolutely agree with you. And I think you put it really well there. And it's about deepening the work and the risk of how's it going this week is it just keeps it on a superficial level. I think for me, I certainly wouldn't say that that's kind of standard for me. But I think the exception is where a client has specifically said that they want to use the therapy as an opportunity to review what they're doing during the week, and they want that support of kind of offloading, and, you know, people want different things from therapy. And so I think for some clients that kind of weekly review can be useful, but I think, as you say, it can be very much also unhelpful and keep it at a more superficial level. I really love what you're saying there about that combination of both kind of live material that's going on in the week, but also something about keeping the threads and keeping the kind of focus of work. And And then there's always that risk, particularly in longer term work, that you kind of lose the focus and it just becomes a bit of a conversation that loses then the kind of emotional momentum, which I think, you know, the research shows is so important. So we don't totally disagree. I mean, it's just about different things for different people at different times.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important. The context makes a big difference.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure if a client said to you, look, I want to, you know, use these time to look at what's happened to me this week, you wouldn't be saying to them, you know, we're not going to do that. You know, preference is important too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you might say to a client, okay, I'm willing to do that. I'm happy to do that. But just, it's also important that maybe we go into stuff. And if you felt as a therapist that actually, you know, that was an avoidance or that they weren't going into stuff during the week because of that, then, you know, I think we'd both kind of raise that with them and have that dialogue.
So one that was on your list, I want to hear you talk about, then we'll think about role-playing some of these, and I have some in mind. But you talked about colluding with the client. And I thought that was a really interesting one, Mick. Will you explain what you mean by colluding with the client?
So the example that I give on the video is where a client is talking about how her boyfriend hasn't done something that she doesn't like, hasn't sent her a message when she was expecting a message. And the colluding was where the therapist starts going, oh, he's a terrible person, isn't he? And, you know, you really shouldn't be hanging around with him. I think it's something about agreeing at a factual level with the client. And the reason that I think that is problematic is for the reasons we've really talked about before, is that it doesn't get into the emotional depth. And rather than kind of giving the client an opportunity to explore what something means for them and maybe some of the more difficult feelings, there's the risk of repeating what a client might be doing a lot already with people around them, which is just, oh, this person's bad and that's bad and, you know, this wasn't helpful. I mean, having said that, something that we've learned from our research is that clients do really appreciate feeling that the therapist is on their side. And I think from the research on super shrinks, feeling that someone's kind of got your back, wants the best for you, really is passionate about helping you improve things in your life. I think that is really important. And feeling that they're there for you. But it's so in terms of the process, that kind of collaborative work, you know, we know from the Alliance is just so critical. But I think the colluding refers to the agreement on the details rather than the it shuts down on the exploration of the experience, which is just so important.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think about that one, Bruce? Did you see it differently?
I think it's one of the trickier things that we do because, you know, clients come in often blaming others for their difficulties. So, you know, my father never paid attention to me. My older brother was the whiz kid, and I never got his attention. And you know, I'm kind of a failure in life because I don't feel seen. It, you know, God damn it, it's all my father's fault about why I'm not a success. Don't you agree? And, well, come on, blaming your father for everything that's gone wrong in your life isn't really helpful. So you want to show understanding, but not really reinforce this idea that the locus of your problems is external. And so, you know, therapists might say, well, yeah, I mean, clearly, your father was not a very validating figure in your life. And yeah, that may be true, but it reinforces this idea that the problems I'm having now are really due to my father, who may be dead. There's nothing we can do about it. So that's kind of the way I interpreted what you said. And I think it's problematic when we try to be empathic and understanding, but we don't really want to approve necessarily of the perspective that's expressed there.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you're saying that your father was not validating and your father didn't understand you, if I start saying, if we start exploring your father and what your father did, it gets away from your feelings about it and it gets away from your anger. I guess what I want to help you explore is your anger about it, your sadness about it. But at the same time, I mean, I think it's interesting that you raise it as a complexity, because maybe sometimes I do want to, you know, if a client has never had that validated, if a client comes to the therapy and nobody has ever said, actually, what your father did was really unhelpful to you, I can really see that they didn't validate you. You know, there's a risk that if I say to you, yeah, you know, that's your feeling, that actually you're not hearing somebody else say that was really hard. So it's a tough balance, isn't it? And,
yeah,
you know, getting that thing of exploring the feeling, but also helping somebody, you know, like to give a more extreme example, if somebody's talking about, say, racism or talking about bullying, mm-hmm. we don't want to just kind of go, that's your feeling, so you really felt there was racism. Sometimes there is racism, and sometimes that needs to be named and understood and recognized for what it is. So sometimes just focusing on the feeling, I think, can feel a bit like avoiding the reality that we live in a world and that things happen. And that helps, you know, to recognize a racism also then helps somebody connect with a feeling. So it's not either or. But I think we both say that, you know, what we're looking at, where the leverage is, for want of a better word, is what somebody can change. And what somebody, I guess, can do is kind of explore their feelings, process their feelings, think about different ways of behaving. And in psychotherapy, like you say, you're not going to change your father. And so having long conversations about what your father did isn't necessarily going to get us anywhere, because that's not the focus. What we can do is change you and how you feel about your father and how you react to people in the world differently.
Yeah. And that kind of process where if people don't give you the attention you think you deserve, then you dismiss them and withdraw from them. And that's problematic.
Yeah, that's problematic.
Yeah. So.
Role plays.
Well, we'll each pick maybe one or two of these that are interesting. The one that I find really important is this idea about affect. And I think about this interchange of a therapist and a client, and it was a actual and actually quite well-known therapist providing therapy, and the client was a woman who is afraid of telling her husband how she feels about how he treats her in different instances, because he's afraid. He's a very hot-headed guy, and she's afraid that he's just going to shut her down, maybe even just leave the marriage, whatever. So she came to therapy and recounting, you know, I stood up to my husband. I told him what he was doing really bugged the shit out of me. And what this was an intake. And what he did was he left. He slammed the door and left. And the therapist says, well, how long have you been married? Okay. Clearly avoiding the affect. I mean, difficult affect. So how do you respond in a way to deepen the affect? And as a person-centered person, this is right up your alley. So talk about a little bit about what you would say differently. And then I got some other examples as well. So Mick, he slammed the door and left.
Right. So, Bruce, I think if this was an intake session, I might be a bit more cautious, and just to understand the context and understand what's going on. Risk assessment would be important. I think, you know, you're raising about issues. Well, let's say this is a bit further down the line and, you know, there's not particular risk issues that we need to be thinking about for this. So you're going to be the client, and you're telling me that he slammed the door. So how was that for you?
Well, I mean, I don't know if he's coming back.
Uh-huh. He's gone, and it sounds like that's what you were worried about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've been married for 5 or 6 years, and I'm always kind of on pins and needles that he's going to walk out and leave me. We have 2 kids, and I can't afford to take care of them on my own.
Oh, yeah. So, and now he's gone, he's closed the door, and you're thinking he's not going to come back?
Yeah. I don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah.
It was just this morning when this happened.
Yeah.
So
how are you? I mean, as you talk about it now, how does it feel talking about it? I wonder if it's, you feel a bit in shock. Do you feel?
Yeah, I'm a bit in shock. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you don't know what's going to happen, do you? You're just thinking.
Yeah, what the hell am I going to do?
What are you going to do?
Oh, what the fuck am I going to do?
And you say, what the fuck, it sounds, what, are you scared?
Yeah, I'm really scared. You know, and talk about this, I'm more scared about how I'm going to live my life if he didn't come back.
Yeah.
As bad as it is, we do have something that's important, and we got a household to manage and kids to raise, and he's pretty good with the kids. But, you know, I felt like I just had to tell him that, you know, when he insults me in front of the kids, I just can't take it. I just kind of lost it.
Yeah. You lost it when you got really angry with him.
Yeah. And for the first time, maybe, I said, you know, God damn it, don't insult me in front of the kids. That's all I said.
Yeah. But I imagine you were feeling when you said it, God damn it, don't insult me in front of the kids. You were feeling, did you feel that kind of anger? Did you feel that rage or?
Well, I walk around angry a lot of the times with how he treats me. So the anger didn't feel new to me.
Okay.
It's in there all the time. But kind of letting it come out, that was new.
What was that like for you?
Well, you know, on the one hand, I felt really good.
Yeah.
You know, I did it. I told him how I felt. But then, you know, goddamn, my worst fear that he would leave.
Yeah, I can really hear that. So there's something about, like, that anger that you felt a lot around him, and you finally let it out. And that actually felt quite good to let that anger out. There was a real kind of letting it out.
Yeah.
But then the other side of that is now the fear. And I guess that's what we got to kind of explore and work with. And
The fear.
Yeah, well, both of those really look kind of like that anger and then the fear.
I just can't think of anything else right now, but what the hell am I going to do if he doesn't come back?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really scary if he doesn't come back.
Yeah.
And I guess we got to, you know, that's something that we can talk about and think together about. What you're going to do now, what is it you feel like you want to do now?
Well, right now, I just want to kind of like call him up and apologize so he'll come back.
Yeah.
So like, I'm sorry, I won't do that again, you know, because I can't take this. I can't take the anxiety about him not coming back. So, yeah. I mean, I just want to say I won't get angry again. I don't know. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's a real anxiety. I can hear that. That's really driven by that anxiety, isn't it, that you've been feeling, is that there's a real fear around, you know, it's so unbearable that you want to bring him up and talk to him and tell him to come back. And I guess what would be useful to explore is whether that's the most helpful thing to do right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mick, this is a good exchange. You know, it's interesting in the role plays because actually start to feel it. I mean, I could feel it in my muscles about getting tense, about feeling like he wasn't coming back.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, I think in that situation, it kind of what you're doing is you're bringing in the emotion to understand more of the situation. I mean, you know, there's sometimes when you're working with emotion that you're going really to kind of unpack and open out that emotion. But I think there was a kind of live situation there where you kind of need to think about what you're going to do in that situation, how you're going to act. There's a lot happening. And why it's useful to understand the emotion is because what we started to do there, particularly at the end, I guess, is understand the fear that was going to drive you to then bring him up and say, come on, I'm really sorry, I come back. And I always think about therapy, you know, as kind of like points of leverage. It's like, where is there possible to kind of change and intervene? And I guess it was thinking about, you know, what you were going to do in that situation. Would you ring him? That was, it felt like an important question. And I think for me, part of being humanistic and part of, you know, the conversation we're having earlier is that understanding the emotion helps me really not take a kind of position. Like, I wasn't thinking, you should ring him up or you shouldn't ring him up or this is terrible. I wanted to understand what you were feeling, to understand why you were wanting to do what you were doing, and then help you think about, okay, there's a really urgent feeling of anxiety there. Is that, maybe that is the best, maybe in that situation, that is the best thing for you to do, to ring him up. Or maybe because we're learning that it's driven by that anxiety, maybe you'll think, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. Well, what was really helpful for me there is it wasn't just exploring my feelings. It was tied to, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And to know what to do, I kind of have to understand what I'm feeling. I mean, I worked with Lee McCullough, who you might know, affect phobia therapy. And she was very clear that just expressing affect in the session wasn't enough. It's also to understand that so I can act in a way that will be beneficial for me. And so I thought that was a really useful part of our interchange, that it wasn't just emotion.
Yeah. I think there's always a question for me, Bruce, as a therapist, that what is it actually we're trying to do here? You know, what is the helpful thing? It's like, where are we going? And sometimes that is about connecting with emotion, learning about the emotion, understanding emotion. Sometimes that might be about thinking about choices and behavior change. We know from the evidence that there's lots of different change pathways in therapy, and being clear about that with clients and having some kind of collaborative agreement on that, I think, is really important to help guide and orientate our work. Working kind of sort of going deeply into emotions can be really, really helpful. Generally, it's helpful, but sometimes, you know, some clients, it might not be what they need or what they want or actually what the most helpful thing is at that point in time.
Yeah.
But it all comes back to, what is it that the client wants? I think we should do one of your what not to's, and you can demonstrate what we'll do instead.
Okay.
Some good practice. I'll be the client this time. So which of your what not to do's would you like to demonstrate?
I want to demonstrate saying too many things.
Okay.
Okay. So you are a client.
Okay. I'm
and a client. I kind of wrote this scenario. Let's say 35, 40-year-old male make you
about my age.
Yeah, about you. And you're married. three children, but you got problems in kind of all facets of your life. Your marriage is not too satisfying.
Thanks, Bruce.
You have problems with intimacy, not okay. just with your wife. There's stress at work. You're struggling with life balance because your work is demanding. So you're going to tell me a story.
Okay, you really know me well, Breeze.
Yeah.
I don't need to role play this one, apart from being 30. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Mick, it sounds like a number of things are bothering you. So
yeah.
Tell me about them. What's going on in your life that's you find so stressful?
I mean, one of the things was with my wife, and we were out with our children and just kind of supposed to be having a relaxed time together and just taking it easy. And I've told you, Bruce, I work so hard every day. It's so stressful. I work 6 days a week. We had a Sunday when we're going out. So we take the kids out, and she's got this plan and she's got this organized. And then it's not just that she's got it all organized, it's that she's then wanting me to do it. She's saying, can you bring these people up? Can you book the restaurant? Can you organize this? Can you, and you know, do this for the kids and get their dinner? And it's so, you know, it just turns it into just one more stressful thing. I just feel like in my life, there is these constant stressors that are going on, and I just don't get a chance to relax. I just want a bloody Sunday to just take it easy for once. You know, I'm going away a lot of weekends. She drives me out of the wall.
Yeah. Well, I hear you saying that there's a lot of different aspects in your life that are problematic.
Yeah.
You're in a stressful occupation, and we know that job stress can really interfere with life satisfaction. And sometimes we discount how important job satisfaction is. So your work is stressful.
Yeah.
There's demand.
Stressful.
You're working long days,
yeah.
Just 6 days a week. And then it also sounds like there's issues in your relationship with your wife. She is somebody who likes to take charge of situations. She's currently not working. She's home with the kids. And so she has time to organize your day off. And you want to sit home and relax. And she wants to do things. Makes sense. She hasn't seen you all week.
She wants me to do things. That's the problem, is that she wants me to do things. I mean, if she wants to do it, but... Yeah, it's like I've got to do stuff. It always seems to be more stress.
Yeah, so you've got the job stress and then the relationship with your wife. And you haven't told me too much about the children, but children's probably an issue in your life as well. So there's a lot of things going on. So... Well, what should we talk about, do you think?
So what are you, Bruce, is that demonstrating the bad therapy or the good therapy?
Well, it's too many things.
Too many things also.
I just wanted
to check. I didn't want to say that was bad. And then you go, that's the good therapy.
Yeah.
No, that's too much. I was disconnected. I mean, I wanted to talk and I could feel my emotions coming up. And I wanted to talk about it and get stuff out. And you were just going on. You were losing me.
You were insistent in breaking in.
I tried to.
Yeah. And so we know something's not right in my response.
Yeah.
Because you're not really listening to what I'm saying.
One thing and then I'd gone. I mean, you know, I was in my emotion. I was in my feelings. I was wanting to tell you this. One reflection was great. I didn't want to talk about the kids at that point, or I didn't want to be redirected over there.
Yeah. Well, here's a therapist who wanted to get the whole picture, right? I've got to know everything that's going on so I can determine where we should intervene. And you, client, just wanted to get this out.
I needed to get it out.
Yeah, so let's do it a little differently.
Okay.
I'll do it. Hey, look, Mick, there's a lot going on in your life. There's a stressful work environment. There's a home life. You don't have much time. But, you know, what really seems to be bothering you at this minute is this idea that when you're home, your wife is determining, or it feels like she's determining, what we should be doing.
You know,
you just want to relax.
You know what it is just, I don't think it's about her. I think it's just this feeling of I can't stop. And I think it's just this feeling that I just never get to slow down. I know she's trying her best, and I know that, you know, work is that, you know, I'm talking to people there, but I never stop. And I worry about that constant sense of, you know, it's like, I feel like I'm just going to burn out. I feel like I'm going to, I can't, Bruce, you know, I actually feel I can't cope, in the sense that I can't just keep on going at this pace. I don't know what to do. I can't. And I feel like there's something behind me just driving me and pushing 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 me. Like when does it, I can't see any break in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of these things you really value. You value your relationship with your wife. But because you're on this treadmill, just going around and around as fast as you can, there's never any time you can just relax and think about and enjoy a moment.
Just to stop. You know, just that sense of story. And I come here and I come and talk to you, Bruce, and I'm just like, ba-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
Yeah. So here's your moment to just relax and think about. And even that's difficult because you feel that pressure from every side, even when you have this 1 hour to yourself to talk about it. Can't let go of it. It's just there all the time.
I mean, okay, so to finish that there, that's very good. I mean, that's really good, Bruce. And what I really liked about the way you were working there is that you kind of came in initially and said it was, you know, was it about my wife? And then when I kind of said, actually, it's not, you just let it go. You didn't go, maybe it is really about your wife, or come on, let's come back. You know, you went with me, which is just so important, I think, that you didn't have a particular agenda or felt like you were kind of traveling with me. And as I was working it out, you were kind of staying, you were bringing stuff in briefly and giving me that space. And actually, you know, interestingly, in the role play, it was a lot about space. And I guess for a lot of clients, it is.
Yeah. Well, interesting about the idea of changing the focus. And that's a difficult thing for therapists to do, I think. We have an idea about what the real issue is. And we may have kind of allegiance to some kind of protocol. And we're going to do that because that's what we think is best for the client, and not be able to change. Oh, yeah, I didn't get that right. And just be able to change on the fly. So there I was thinking, yeah, you're really kind of upset about your wife because she's controlling, and it's the controlling aspect. But that's not what it was at all. It was the fact that you know, your life is just a wheel where you keep running and running.
Yeah, and you allow me to go with that. But I mean, interestingly, Bruce, that I think sometimes, you know, again, we're talking about balance and get a balance, because I think sometimes our clients do want us to bring them back or interrupt them. One of the things we've done around preferences with John Norcross is I was amazed how many clients said, actually, they do want to be interrupted and they do want to be held to task. A lot of clients are aware that they can go off and start kind of talking about things that aren't so important. So often as therapists, finding that balance between staying with the client but also bringing them back to what's maybe the relevant, what the hot spots are, is really important. And I think a lot of that comes back to this question of emotion. It's like, where's the emotion? Where's the feeling? What is it that really matters? And having conversations with clients, something about where they want to go, what's important to them, gives us that kind of guidance on where it is, maybe, you know, where we need to give the client space and where it is that maybe we need to bring them back into something that maybe that they've gone off from talking about.
Mm-hmm. Say more about the preferences, because I know that's an area of interest for you and in your work with John. And when we think of preferences, we often think of preferences for a particular therapy. I want dynamic therapy, or I want a behavioral treatment. But you're talking about interpersonal style preferences.
Exactly.
Say a bit more about that. Preferences. How would you know that I have a preference not to be interrupted, for instance?
Well, yeah, so we're talking about what we would call within treatment or within therapy preferences, as opposed to between therapy preferences. And I mean, what we've developed as an inventory of preference is a way of asking clients. But, you know, it's an inventory, it's a measure to understand some of those, as you say, kind of style preferences. Do you want more therapist directedness or less? Do you want more emotional intensity or less? But it's really about kind of starting that conversation off. You know, I would ask you, Bruce, if you were coming to see me for a first session, I would be asking you about, have you had therapy before? Was there particular things that you valued or didn't value? Do you have any strong preferences? As a way of kind of opening up that conversation. And then maybe if I was, you know, we were having a few sessions, we'd come back to it and we'd talk about it. And how did you find that? And maybe you'd be saying, well, actually, I think I need a little bit more prompting, or maybe I feel like I need a little bit more space. I mean, I think, you know, when we're looking at things that maybe aren't helpful, I think assuming that we know what clients need and want is maybe another unhelpful thing. We certainly have our intuitive understandings and kind of that can be really useful, but it's not always right. And giving space to clients to express that, even though, I mean, clients don't always know, of course, clients don't always know, but having some of that conversation with clients explicitly, transparently, and is part of forming that collaborative alliance that then means that we can work together. And I certainly think as a therapist, that's a really important part of our work, is getting on the same page, working together to work it out, what clients want from therapy, how they think they can get there, discussing together and exploring together about the best routes towards that, trying it out, doing it, seeing how it goes, exploring it. And keeping that as a kind of ongoing conversation.
Yeah, I really like the idea of asking clients about their previous therapy and what was helpful and what wasn't helpful, because you certainly don't want to mimic what the client found unhelpful previously.
Yeah. And we find that something that we find is that a lot of clients, going back to an earlier conversation, I mean, this is a great way actually of exploring what clients don't like. And in fact, there's a research project with colleagues over in the Czech Republic exploring what we call dispreferences, like what clients don't like, that we're going to be analyzing, you know, big body of data on. But I think one of the things that comes up quite a lot is a therapist who's just too kind of unfocused, just too, you know, clients will say something like, they were really nice, they were really kind, but they just didn't push me enough. I mean, we do hear that a lot more than a therapist who pushed me too much. Sometimes you hear that, but a lot of clients
say, that's really interesting, because they're asking for in some sense, a more directive or at least a more focused. As a non-directive therapist, I hate to say to you, they're asking for more directive.
But
I think it's a focus. You know, I'm fascinated by watching Carl Rogers' videotapes because there is a focus and a theme to what he's getting at that's very impressive. And I think what you're recounting is that, well, I go to therapy, we talk about some important things, but I don't really understand how this is going to be helpful.
Yeah.
So one of the things on my list, which I didn't mention, is explaining to the client how therapy works and how it's going to be helpful.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about chapter one of the CBT manual for depression, where you talk about the basis of depression based in cognition and faulty schemas and so forth. But it's an ongoing process all through therapy to explain why this is important.
Yeah.
So
absolutely, Bruce. I mean, we know from the evidence that some explanation, socializing the client, as they call it, is a helpful factor. And I think for me, one of my real don't do's is about just diving into therapy without any explanation, like in a first, you know, some of those clients have got so much they just want to talk. But I think you have to say something to clients about what they're doing there, why it's helpful, particularly if they're kind of scratching around. If a client says, you know, I'm not sure if this is helpful, and me as a Rogerian therapist just reflects that back and says, it sounds like you're not sure if it's helpful or not. You know, we know from the work on ruptures, the importance of standing back from our model and being able to have a conversation in a real relationship with clients about what it is that we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think that's also ethically part of a respectful relationship. Is that I explain it to you. You know, if you go through a medical procedure, they tell you what it is that's going to happen and why you're doing it.
Right, exactly.
I remember, Bruce, when I was about 15, 16 and went to the Tavistock for psychoanalysis, I just went in this room. The guy just sat there, didn't say a word. And I felt like I was on another planet. I had no idea what was going on.
How is this going to be helpful?
Yeah.
So the client I role played with you might have said to you, hey, Mick, how is saying how I feel going to be helpful to me?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
If he doesn't come back, you're asking me how I'm feeling.
Yeah, but Bruce, before that, when we'd started, we would have talked about what it is that you wanted. And maybe you would have said, well, I want to work out what I want to do in my relationship. Maybe you'd said, I just want a space to get out my feelings. Maybe you'd said, you know, I want to think through things. So I already would have had a sense early on, and we would have talked about it, about what it is that we're doing together. So, you know, you might well ask that, but I'd be tying it back to what we talked about at the beginning and saying, well, you know, Bruce, you said you wanted to work out what to do and, you know, understanding your feelings, I guess, is part of that process. So that there's a kind of clarity and a hopefully a rationale. It's not just kind of left to chance or it's unclear to the client. I think people have a right to understand what therapy is about.
Yeah.
It's not a magic wand. We always say it's not a magic wand. It does something in a way for a reason. We don't always understand it, but we can try and understand it.
We know that from the placebo research, for instance. You need an explanation of how this is going to work. You got to have some belief that the hard work you're going to do leads to some outcome. When I'm supervising therapists, I often say, well, I'm going to go in and talk to your client and ask them to explain to me why what they're doing in therapy will help them achieve their goals or reduce their distress. And if they can't explain it to me, then there's something wrong. They have to understand why it is we're processing emotions or why I'm doing a thought listing technique. Why is this helpful? So that explanation, really important, the education. And again, kind of non-directive therapists would probably be the least likely to explain this. And you're saying, yeah, it's really important to do.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the paradoxes about being non-directive is that if you are non-directive with a client who actually doesn't want that, then actually you're being very directive in that non-directivity, which is why, you know, my work's kind of moved more in the direction of what we call pluralism, which is really, you know, as we've been talking about, trying to work the clients to work out what it is that they want and to be adaptive within the skills that I have to different ways of working so that, you know, it's a non-directivity at a meta level, if you like, rather than me being the expert in what's going to help the client, including being the expert that the non-directivity is going to help. Actually, I want to stand back from that and recognize that CBT can be really helpful. EMDR can be really helpful. And there's so many different ways of helping a client. You know, I guess my number one not to do would be don't assume that what you think is right is going to be right for the client. You know, it might be, and it might be fantastic. But I think when we assume, including non-directivity, you know, when we assume that that is what's going to help the client, when our way of doing therapy becomes like a kind of faith or like a religion, which we see sometimes in the therapy world, then that becomes so much more about me as the therapist rather than actually listening to you as a client. It doesn't mean that I can do everything. You know, if a client, you know, if I'm person sensei, client wants CBT, doesn't mean I just become a CBT therapist, but it does mean respecting that, talking about that, recognizing my limits and not feeling like my way is the only way.
Yeah. Well, Mick, you hit on another pet peeve of mine, and that is a therapist who says, intake session or first session, what's your problem and so forth. Then I go, well, here's the way I work. This is what I do as a therapist. Because it says to me, you haven't listened to how the client wants to work in therapy. And what you described is a very attuned stance towards how do they want to work in therapy. Now, of course, I want to do it in an effective way. And if I feel like they're asking for something that's not going to be helpful, we're going to kind of have to work that out. But you have to understand how they want to work in therapy and be flexible in your approach. I mean, you're not going to morph into a CBT counselor, but for somebody who is quite maybe not psychologically minded and more instrumental, there is going to be more instrumentality in what you do because you're listening to how the client wants to work.
So I think that's really the starting point, isn't it, Bruce, is listening to what the client wants and being able to take things from there. You know, and we need to be clear about what we can offer and what we can do and what we can't do. But as you say, it shouldn't be, this is, you know, in the power relationship when we have so much power as a therapist to start by saying, right, this is what I do is really kind of saying to the client, this is the right way of doing it. And might just not be for the client.
Yeah. And we know from research that flexibility is instrumental for the alliance and for outcome.
Yep.
Not to be rigid. Nevertheless, and this is something I kind of harp on too, there needs to be a coherence of what we're doing. And this makes sense. We're working towards a goal in a certain way. And I understand why it's going to be helpful.
Yeah. And not just flexibility, Bruce, but also, of course, with the research on humility and showing that as a therapist, you know, if I question and don't believe that just my way is the right way, then actually the research is also now showing that that's associated with improved outcomes. But you're right. I mean, it needs to be a coherence. It can't just be a kind of ambiguous, kind of diffuse, whatever. It needs, and that's where the alliance comes in. You know, that's the alliance of working together to work out that coherence. based on what it is a client wants and what they want to do.
Yeah. And it takes some careful listening. I mean, you ask what was helpful and unhelpful in your therapy, but it also takes an attunement to see the reaction of the client to what you're doing. Often clients don't want to say, you know, I really don't want to do that homework. I don't see why it's useful. I'm not going to do it. They're going to go, yeah, I'll give it a try.
Yeah.
But you can tell they're not engaged in it. So instead of saying, great, we'll talk about it next week, see how it went. No, to really say, well, sounds like you don't think this is going to be very helpful. So let's find out what about it you find unhelpful.
Yeah. One of the things we really know from the research in terms of deference is that it's really difficult for clients to question, to say, I don't want to do something. So, you know, if you ask a client, like, was that helpful? Of course, clients are going to say, yeah. You really have to give clients a space to say, and that's why, going back to what you're saying earlier about starting with a client, because by the time you said, this is what I do, this is what I think is going to work, very few clients are going to say, well, actually, I think differently.
Yeah. You know, what really has struck me about our conversation, we're coming towards the end, but what has struck me, Mick, is we're talking about kind of the transactions in therapy at a moment-to-moment basis and invoking the research. So we're not just making this stuff up, you and me. There's actually research that guides the moment-to-moment interactions with clients. And I think that's very cool. So when people say the research is irrelevant to clinical work, I think they had to listen to this episode, because we're saying we know much about this in terms of what we do in therapy.
Yeah.
And again, that's very cool.
It was really cool, and it really helps. You know, it's not that the research is right every time, and it's not the research tells us what to do. But as you say, Bruce, it's guiding. It's part of a process that we can look at and we can learn from. We can change. I mean, Carl Rogers himself talked about the way that the facts are friendly, and that it was painful. It's sometimes you believe something and you believe something is right, and it's painful to realize that actually that's not always the case. That, you know, for me, for instance, it was painful to read about CBT's effectiveness and how it can be really helpful. It was painful to see these studies showing that clients wanted therapist directedness. I wish it had been otherwise. But actually, you know, Rogers says that that's about learning. That's about reorganization. So for me, being person-centered ultimately is about being open to that evidence, about challenging myself to be willing to learn, to evolve, not to hold a rigid position, but to have that genuine flexibility, which comes from the evidence, from clinical practice, from talking to colleagues like yourself, from reading, that all these things can help us be the most helpful practitioner with a client and listening. And then we can bring that all in. And clients want us to bring that in. They don't want a blank slate. They want to bring in our expertise, our knowledge, so that we can give them the best that we can give them and in relation to their learning and knowledge.
What you're expressing there, Mick, in that observation, is exactly what Helen Nissen Lee talks about: professional self-doubt. You take kind of a humble view of what you're doing, and making the effort to improve, and not saying, "I know exactly what to do. I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm good at it." You're saying, "Yeah, we got to be open, even to evidence that contradicts our received view of what we're doing, both in terms of the research, but also in terms of the client. Oh, I think my assumption about you is wrong. I got to think about this differently." Mick, this has been great. We could go on, for another hour or two. But I appreciate what you do and how you think about psychotherapy, and the willingness to do some role plays live and on the record. So very much appreciative, and we'll have you back and discuss some of these other topics, because this has been fascinating.
Thanks, Bruce. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and really inspiring, and lots to think about.
And as always, today's podcast was brought to you by CarePaths EHR. Are you a clinical supervisor, or do you run a training clinic? CarePaths is a comprehensive electronic health record system built with you in mind. Research shows that therapists get better outcomes and improve more over the course of their careers when they regularly measure their clients' treatment progress and experiences in therapy, and then discuss those measures collaboratively. Along with a host of other features, CarePaths makes it easy for therapists to integrate measurement-based care into their practice with just a few clicks. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about our EHR system designed with training clinics in mind, and join us on the path toward making therapy better. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. We hope to see you next time.